Hi, Bobby here. As promised, we are re-releasing an episode this Monday and next Monday from our archive. This one was first released a little over a year ago, so includes previous host Annie Harris, and tackles a topic that has come up a few times in recent interviews. Also, by happy coincidence, since the first episode of Drag Race UK has just been released on BBC iPlayer, we do talk a little about gender expression through drag. So with all that said, I hope you enjoy the episode. This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. Annie and me are here today in...
Annie and I
are here recording from Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I went to see Joe's show recently while I was up here. And I was really blown over from it. It's really powerful. It's really funny. And it just, a lot of it was spot on with how I feel about masculinity and how that holds men back and how that can contribute to mental illness and potentially be a preventative thing in men seeking the help they need. So it was something where I knew I wanted to do this topic at some point for the podcast, and then I saw his show, which is themed around toxic masculinity, and it all just seemed ideal.
Perfect.
So we'll just start off with a few statistics. First off, according to the BBC, suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 50. When it's talked about men's mental health, suicide constantly comes up with it being such a big killer. And it's thought that a lot of that is to do with them not reaching out, not seeking help, that suicide then becomes more of an option because somehow, strangely, the stigma of that is less than the stigma of being vulnerable or asking for help or crying or being emotional.
It's sort of very reflective of that idea of the black and white, traditionally masculine thinking in a way. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like it's something either is or it isn't. You're either dead or alive. You're not suffering. You can't suffer, so you have to be dead or alive and thriving. You know, it sort of reflects that black and white, no grey area field of interpretation, I think, that toxic masculinity really represents.
Yeah, and maybe that's why in this idea of masculinity that's very narrow, mental illness fits less, because it's not black and white.
No, absolutely.
It's a spectrum, and even experiences of the same condition can be vastly different for different people.
Sure.
And therefore, something maybe like physical illness is more understood. Like, we're used to seeing, like, football players, and they, you know, they go down if something happens and they get rushed straight off to hospital.
Yeah.
And they're not seen as weak for that happening. They've been injured and they need help.
Yeah.
And it's that's a lot more black and white.
Absolutely.
In a way that...
There's a visual cue to say this person is in pain or this person is unwell. And then we could talk about hidden illnesses, invisible illnesses.
Maybe it's easier with something like that because you don't have to open up about your emotions, because it's, you know, if you're bleeding, you're bleeding.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell anyone. They
can
see
it. Yeah,
you
can just literally just show them and be like, look at my bleeding arm or my bleeding knee or whatever.
Yeah, and you can have as much bravado as you want. They'll still help you.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll be like, oh, no, it's fine, you know, and they're like, oh, no, you know, there's that visual.
Yeah,
that visual
fine,
cue.
I'll go to a hospital.
Yeah, fine, of course, yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that's why suicide continually comes up as a theme around this. It's interesting what you've reminded me of there as well, is this sort of difference in like male-female approaches to other people as well. So I've continually seen in my own life, and there's been many studies into this, how if you're going through something difficult in your life, let's say, for example, a breakup or like some family drama or whatever it is, a female friend is more likely to sit in the feelings with you and talk them through and get into the emotions, whereas a male friend may be more likely to want to fix it.
Yeah.
And I know I've been guilty of that a lot. I'm very keen to often jump in and be like, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to get back at them for this? How are we going to make you feel okay? What ice cream flavour do you want? Here, take these solutions.
Here's the Ben and Jerry's. Yeah.
Because maybe somewhere I've internalised that fear of emotions or that wanting to press it down and make it better and just fix it.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far to say as they are more likely, but I think they're just more likely to be expected to be that way, to fit into those roles. So, for example, yeah. I'm very proud of the fact that I ban both of those in sort of a crisis. I'm, oh, hun, you know, I'm your listening ear, I'm here for you. Just then, I'm not going to try and fix you, but then at the end of the conversation, I'll say, well, do you want my advice? Do you want to know what I think? And if they don't, then that's fine. And if they do, I'm like, okay, what do we do next? Like, how can we fix that? You know, so I'm quite proud to be able to offer both sides of the spectrum, I say in air quotes, in that. I think that's super important. I think it's important to be a listening ear or a fixer.
One other stat I wanted to bring in here is one from a previous episode that really struck me. And that was when we had the episode on eating disorders with Hannah Brown. That is that 1.6 million people in the UK are affected by an eating disorder, which, first of all, that blows my mind every time I hear it.
Yeah.
You know, we're currently in Edinburgh. When I'm not here, I live in Birmingham. That many million people is more than the population of both cities combined.
That's insane.
And sometimes you need to put that visual in.
Yeah, but I think people think that typical image of an eating disorder is someone who's very thin, where you have to remember that the words eating disorder put together just basically mean a disorder with your eating. So you could, that brings in people with bulimia, that brings in with people who have just simple problems with their relationship with food, people who may be very overweight. You know, I think we think eating disorder and we immediately think anorexia, you know, but there's so many more facets to that. And we could talk about this forever. I mean, or you could just go back to the episode with Hannah.
Well, Hannah highlighted that, you know, eating disorder comes in all shapes and sizes.
It's insane. But still, regardless of all of that, it's still a ridiculously high number. Terrifying.
It's crazy. So further to that, 11% of that 1.6 million are male. And we just did a really quick calculation to find out, and that's 176,000 people.
That's a lot. I mean, I wonder what city that's... I wouldn't even know, do you know what I mean? I mean, I live in Brighton, I reckon it's around that.
All right, Siri's going to tell us.
Go on, Siri.
What's the population of Brighton?
The population of Brighton is 160,000.
Oh.
Bang on.
Maybe Brighton and Hove together.
I don't know. We're not going to get into Hove. Yeah. Siri, you've done your job today.
Thanks, Siri.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that's massive as well. Mm. You know, and if you think about living there, and that's every person you walk past.
Sure.
But that's something that even with myself, you know, I think that I'm, you know, pretty progressive when it comes to gender. But even still, 11% really surprised me when I recorded that episode originally.
Sure.
And I thought, you know, why? Why does it surprise me? I'm living with an eating disorder myself. I know other people that are male that do. You know, why does that surprise me? But I think, you know, I talked to Kat about it off air, and she said to me, well, the whole world seems to be pretending like male eating disorders don't exist.
Mm.
And I think that can be the case for so many mental illnesses, but particularly one like that maybe carries more stigma, because the idea of having a condition around how you look is pinned down as something more feminine.
Feminine, I was going to say, it links so heavily back to toxic masculinity and the idea that men just, we just get on with it. We don't worry about silly things like the way that we look and our appearance.
Yeah, we just are.
We just are, because we're men and we are superior in some way that, you know, can't really describe or understand.
I think it's this idea that we're not meant to be pretty.
Mm.
That's not...
Or care about your appearance.
Yeah, we're not raised to have appearance as the thing that you value. We're raised in a kind of heteronormative way that we're the one that chooses the woman, we're not the one that's chosen.
Yeah.
And therefore we're competing on being a provider, we're not competing on value of appearance. You know, those are big overarching terms. Obviously, I don't think like this, you don't think like this.
No.
But this, when we talk about stereotypical masculinity or toxic masculinity, it's this narrowing.
Mm.
It's this putting men into this box. And it affects women too.
Because absolutely.
If you're a girl and you're growing up and you're in the playground and you're, you know, quite a dominant personality, you might be called bossy, whereas I might be told I have leadership ability.
I was always told that I was bossy as a child. My mother always used to say, oh, Annie, you're so bossy. And then my brother would be praised for the same traits, you know, leadership.
I'm literally your boss.
Yeah.
And nobody calls me bossy.
No, you are bossy, but that's fine because I love you. But I think we're just as bossy as each other. Bossy is a very interesting and delicate and sort of very loaded term. I think that toxic masculinity affects everyone, not just men. I absolutely agree with that sentiment. I recently went to see a show called Glittery Clittery. Can I say that on the podcast? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine. It's called It's a Consensual Party. It's by some ladies called the Fringe Wives Club. And their show is basically like a sort of all-star, like, sequined, cabaret, feminist, badass, like, let's take down the patriarchy kind of thing. And they've got this song called He Only Does It Because He Likes You. And they have these three verses. The first verses are, when I was four, this boy bit me on the playground and it really hurt. And I went to the teacher and she said, it's okay, he only did it because he likes you. And then when she's a teenager, this happens. And they say, oh, it's okay, he's only mean to you because he likes you. And then when she's 25, she's on the train and some guy like rubs up against her in the crowd. And it's okay because I feel oddly flattered but also disgusted at the same time, because we've always had that instilled in us that men are mean to us because they fancy us. You know, that's like the first thing we're told as kids. Like, don't let him be, you know, oh, it's okay if he picks on you because he probably fancies you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's such an important point to pick up on, because there's this repressing of male emotion.
Sensitivity.
That we talk about plenty in the episode. And it's almost stripped down to a point where you're allowed to be happy and you're allowed to be angry.
Mm.
And they're the two acceptable emotions.
Yeah.
So you can be pissed off for how you're feeling, but you're not allowed to be sad.
No.
Heaven forbid. Like, yeah. And I think that's a big part of not only why it can be difficult for men in particular accessing support and breaking through that mental barrier, or, you know, admitting to themselves even that they need help and they're, you know, they're not right and they're sad and they're struggling. But also, I think it can, on the flip side, be a big contributing factor in why more emotional situations end in violence.
Absolutely.
With guys.
Absolutely.
You know, like pub fights. And I don't want it to seem, whilst I didn't prepare stats for this specifically, you know, I have come from a background of having worked for the police. So I can say with plenty of first-hand experience, there are more male violent offenders than female violent offenders.
Yeah.
If you can't
sexy
already,
throat noise bumps.
If you can't already tell, this is something that we have a lot of opinions on, toxic masculinity.
Oh god.
So I'm really glad to have, you know, got into this, and we'll go into the episode with Joe in just a moment.
So excited.
And talk about that more. You'll really love him. He's a great comedian. He'll tell you all about the show that he's got on at the festival here in the episode, and it's a bit of an experiment. This is the first time we're having a comedian on the show.
Yeah.
And so we'll see what this kind of structure looks like and what going for a big broad topic like this looks like, and see how you guys find that. So do definitely give us feedback. But first, this week's Audible recommendation.
I've just finished listening to The Secret by Rhonda Byrne as an audiobook through Audible. Absolutely loved it, and listened to it while I was driving. It's all about shifting your attitude of negativity and lack to one of gratitude and abundance, and instantly completely transformed my life and the way of thinking that I have around things that affect me negatively. I absolutely love this book, would recommend it to anyone, all ages, any background. It's superb. You can download your first audiobook for free with our link bit.ly/mentalbooks, linked in the description.
My name is Joe Sutherland. I am a comedian performing up and down the country on the UK circuit, and we are currently at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where I have a show called Toxic, which is just a sort of bounce around a few stories about how gender expectations can maybe affect people. And by people, I mean me, because come on, that's what a show is always going to be about. And, you know, that ranges from how we treat young boys and girls if they default from their gendered expectations, how men and dads are expected to behave, and then how, even how in like a same-sex couple, how people might still project like gendered heteronormative values or sort of characteristics onto you, and you have to either like conform or push against those, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, just a little bit about how, just a little bit about just admitting to my own times that I've maybe questioned my own gender. And I think that's maybe something that a lot of queer, or is gay the better term perhaps, for people who gender
as
a
non-straight,
but I sort of wonder, because queer is so inclusive, that that is obviously going to include people who are a little more comfortable admitting that they've questioned gender, or that they maybe move through it fluidly, whereas I think if certainly if you identify as gay, then maybe the way that we view the term gay is now seen as being quite concrete. I don't know. I don't know if that's right.
I know what you mean. I think it's considered quite a definitive term. So for me, I don't have any kind of set label over sexuality. I'm far more interested in like the person behind the gender, and so I date people of like any gender or gender identity. So I would consider myself non-straight.
Cool.
But I wouldn't have a set label.
What a catch-all. That's really good. But I have spoken to a few people who now, as adults, date exclusively the same gender as themselves, and a few of them have said, "Oh, you know what? I had that phase as a kid. I thought actually maybe I was trans, but I had never talked about it because I don't want to do a disservice to people who are trans. Mm-hmm. I also don't want to be fodder for any bigots to kind of set to be able to sort of." Think of any of these things as a phase. And so I think people tend to like bury that experience a little bit because they don't want to be open to the scrutiny, perhaps.
I definitely understand that. And they feel they somehow have to like represent that then. Like for myself, I don't feel part of the LGBT community. I've never really been involved. I've never even been to like a gay bar or anything. I've far more consider myself like an ally, and I'll be all for like I'd go to Pride with someone, but it wouldn't really fill my parade. Mm-hmm. I've got other things like, you know, St. Patrick's Day parade that feel far more like my people and my history. So in terms of what you were saying about people having to represent it, I don't feel I could be a representative of the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. So I'm keen to kind of, I guess I do kind of separate myself because I'm like, I don't have a lot of the shared experience there. I've not had people discriminate against me. And maybe that's because I'm partly quite strong-willed and they don't want to try it. but I've never been really discriminated against based on sexuality or gender. I mean, that's not surprising being a white male. but yeah, so you mentioned about trans people there. So is that something that you ever thought you might have been trans based on your gender identity?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. As a child, certainly. For years, I just sort of thought that makes so much more sense. And that looks like a surefire way to be happy. You, obviously, little did I know, like, at the anguish that goes into, that can go into a trans experience. But it just sort of, you know, with everyone sort of saying that boys had to be a certain thing and you're not that sort of certain thing, you're not quite doing it right, it just sort of felt like, oh, then the other option must be that I'm actually something else inside, which I still was, and that something else was just me. You know, that something else was amazing. And I was lucky enough to have some good supportive people around who were like, you know what, you don't have to be boring. Like, you don't have to be like those boys. You can just do it like your way.
Yeah.
And so then put the pieces together over the course of 20 years, I guess.
It makes a lot of sense, like you thinking that when you were younger. I think from a really young age, we see these gender boxes.
Mm.
I still find it a bit weird that like, we have this whole gendering thing with colour, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was within 100 years ago in the US, the colours were actually the opposite way around. And it was off the back of like a marketing company whose name I've forgotten, but they were really struggling and they thought, we need to come out with some radical campaigns to save the company. And they swapped the gendering of colours round. So previously pink was like meant to be quite a masculine and strong colour, and you know, blue was more kind of cute and feminine. Like they were the kind of words that went along with those colours. And then this company swapped it. It made big shockwaves in advertising, and now not many people know they used to be the other way around.
I mean, was it seen as like radical at the time as a sort of like gender equalizer, or was it?
I think it was just radical because like... they just switched it up. It was okay. Just like, why are they doing that? And it made people take note, and then soon everyone jumped on it and it became a trend
okay. That's
now normalized today. So my point there really is like, from a really young age, we have this gendering of colours and other types of like gender boxes put onto us. And it seems like quite a logical way that your mind was like, well, I don't fit that one that I've been assigned at birth. Maybe that one makes more sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because you're sort of told, well, these are your two options, you know, like, go on, pick one. But what if, can I just go here in the middle? No, it's cold in the middle. Like, you've got to pick one.
Yeah, and a lot of people like to pretend that that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Because I think for many people that do prescribe to this kind of binary idea of gender, it's something that's a threat to that. That if there's people that are in the middle, it's mm-hmm. a threat. And I think that's why, until things like that change, performers like drag queens, they'll never be mainstream mm-hmm. until people dispense with that idea of you're either male or female, because they get people to question that in the same way trans people do. And I think that's why there's so much abuse held at trans people, which really doesn't involve the people that are somehow offended by these people's lives.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, like, maybe that's because I sit in the sort of like wanky lefty artsy world, but it feels like drag just is actually quite mainstream in that regard now, and if anything has lost much of its like radical potential in terms of the drag that has broken through and that you do now see on the Jonathan Ross show or the sort of prime time stuff. I mean, you've got to take things with a pinch of salt, you've got to take things within their sort of context, so it might still be radical in a certain household to see the 11th series of a show that's like lost its rawness and what kind of made it exciting. Mm-hmm. But to an audience, it's still like, oh my God, they're dressing up as women. I can't believe it. And it's like, ugh. But actually they've just created their own code of reference, which is still cool. And like, I still think it provides a great like unity for very young audiences. Mm-hmm. You know, you look online at the sort of the conventions that these performers go to, or some of the live shows that they do, and it's young kids who, through watching it online and through finding a community online, then get really into all the trappings that go with it, in the same way that you would if you idolize a pop star. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you loved David Bowie in the sort of the Alan Zane period, you might be painting your own lightning bolt. I hope I got the character name right there for the lightning bolt face. But you know, it sort of feels like it's come around to that sort of iconography and idolatry, and that feels a little bit distant from what actual gender fucking could otherwise achieve.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, in terms of going back to what you were saying about growing up then, was there a particular point then that you realised it was okay, where you felt in terms of like a gender spectrum or?
Well, I don't know, because maybe it shifted around a bit. There were definitely times when I actually had fun like kind of being one of the lads and like trying that on, but it mm-hmm. definitely felt like, oh, I'm putting this on. This is a costume mm-hmm. for, you know, for age 13. But then around at like 17, it was like, oh no, none of that, thanks. So I sort of went completely the other way and was like, I'd rather completely obscure it and blur the line. So I would wear, you know, white eyeliner and bleach my hair blonde and grow it down to my shoulders, so that I just really, really enjoyed walking around the corridors in college mm-hmm. and hearing people go, what is that? And you know, that's that slightly aggressive behaviour, but there was something I was like, I've got you. I've confused you. Yes, I win.
I get that. It's kind of you taking ownership of it. It's like, I'm going to be even weirder than you think I'm weird. Like,
that's it. And I think what that maybe was like a slight fear of, I know this sounds odd, like a slight fear of coming out. So what I did was make myself look insane. Well, not, you know, that's a very triggering word for a mental health podcast. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Well, the show is called Mental, so it'll be fine.
But, you know, it was like, it's in sort of like small town, Midlands, it sort of felt a bit like I could quite easily be accepted by being like, oh, the gay best friend. Oh, I love gays. Oh, you're so funny. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, I don't, no, that's too easy. I don't want to be your accessory. I actually want to push you away a bit more. And so I guess it was a sort of like solo punk moment of like, I'm actually going to make myself a little bit, I'm going to make you feel a bit uncomfortable by not looking like either male or female. I just want to look like Tilda Swinton.
And it sounds like in many ways, if you had allowed people to do that and like just relabel you, you'd go from trying to fit into the boy box to trying to fit into the stereotypical gay box.
Yeah.
And that's not really an upgrade.
And I certainly saw friends doing that and enjoying themselves for it. And definitely, you know, I'm very envious of the amount of teenage sex they were having because they'd admitted that to themselves. But instead, I just needed to go at my own pace, I think. And the easiest way to do that was to, was to sort of take on, I guess, at the time, what would today be termed a more like non-binary presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how did that then change how you felt about yourself?
I felt quite powerful, I suppose. But it's the same as like, and maybe this is true for a lot of comedians, like when you are, you know, if you're a bit on the sidelines in school and stuff, the way that you battle with people's, reactions to you or people, you know, people like pushing you around, calling you names or something, the way that you build up a wall is like, oh, well, if I'm just really quick, if I've got a really sharp tongue mm-hmm. and I know how to actually throw out a funny insult as quickly as possible, basically by being incredibly Machiavellian, like identifying someone's weakness mm-hmm. and mocking them for it publicly, then they won't, you know, then they'll step off. So in a way, that is a powerful feeling in the moment, as was sort of looking a way that made people feel a bit uncomfortable. So combining these two things, being like quite acerbic and bitchy, as well as looking like a sort of fashion alien, meant that, you know, in those moments you felt very powerful, but it's also a bit isolating. You feel a bit lonely because no one quite knows how to deal with you, I suppose.
Yeah, and you're still figuring that out yourself. Because something I did, which I didn't realise how useful this was when I was younger, but I think from quite a young age, I just decided with certain things that I was just going to be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, I didn't always feel like I fitted in, but not in a way that I was, you know, being bullied or anything. I just thought, like, creatively, there wasn't a place for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I always wanted to be self-employed when I grew up, and like mm-hmm. adults would ask me what I wanted to do when I grow up, and I'd have a list. I wouldn't just have one answer, like a doctor or a lawyer. And so I think from a young age, I kind of knew I would have to tread my own path. And so things like gender and sexuality kind of came lower on the pecking order. I was like, I'm just going to be okay with that stuff.
Just working on my portfolio right now. So yeah. Can we get to the pronouns later?
Yeah, so I don't know. So I think that was really helpful for me because it just meant that I didn't get the anxiety over that I maybe otherwise would have done. And it took me a while to figure out where I did land sexuality-wise. And in the in-between stage, I didn't mind as much because I was just trying things out.
That's interesting. I probably did the same. I well wanted to be a fashion designer. Mm-hmm. I was from 14. I was like, that's really it. I want to go to St. Martin's. And so I left school at 16 to go to college and do a BTEC. And I just lived for it. I lived and breathed it. I worked through the night, like just for 2 years because I just loved doing it. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, I think postponed all of that sort of angst-inducing teenage stuff in a way. Although, well, it didn't postpone, it sort of brushed it to the sidelines. So then in the middle of the night, you're like, oh, what is the world? What is life? Oh my God, I hate everything. But then, you know, get up at 8 and it's like, right, I'm going to draw 12 sketches today.
Yeah, and it sounds like you went to your tribe.
Yeah,
and they were able to look after you to a certain extent. Because it's something that you kind of briefly mentioned earlier. You referred to it as like a costume of being one of the lads. Mm-hmm. And it's often also referred to as like a mask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's incredible how easily we can all fall for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's only ever been two people that I've like talked about the podcast to off air that have cried. And one of them was male and one of them was female. And it surprised me far more when the male started crying. And I just thought, you know, looking back on that, that's really weird, because I don't think I'd be the sort of person to have those stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But sometimes they can just be put in so deep that even if I think I'm okay with it, it's still in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's in the air. Like, I don't think you can blame yourself for that. It's just what we breathe in every day.
Do you see a time when that changes?
I don't know. At a snail's pace, perhaps. I don't know. Everything's so like messy at the moment. So I don't know where, I don't know how to like allocate like the areas of culture that I know about. My experience is so centered in like Western culture. And so and not only that, but very lefty, bloody artsy wank. So within that, I sort of feel like, yeah, we're really getting quite far, but I don't know. You know, there might be other countries where it's like men cry all the time. You know, like in Morocco, it's so beautiful how men walk down the streets holding hands. Mm. And that's like just a great thing. And they kiss on the lips and stuff. But then I don't know what their attitude is to crying. Like they might have something similar to what we sort of feel we still have, which is like, oh, no, you don't do that. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. And things like that kind of give me hope, because even like in this country, as recently as like when Shakespeare was writing, it was quite normal for men to greet with a snog. And like that, you know, that was at never point considered like cheating or anything. And they would, men would often have like relationships with male friends of theirs. And that was just something that is just a bit of fun and something that happened. Whereas although the world is like so far forward in many ways, it's quite odd that that's such a bigger deal now. Like, and it wasn't then. And, you know, things like, women weren't allowed to perform in most plays, so men did the roles in women's clothes, and that again wasn't a big deal then. Whereas we've gone in this weird arc of it being weirder and weirder, and now it's coming back down again.
And then spread it around as well. Like, that is a legacy of colonialism as well, that like cultures that formerly were a little more open in embracing or like acknowledging the ideas of a third gender and sort of a man taking a male partner as well as their wife, and, or, you know, like particularly if they were out doing field work or, you know, on boats and things, and that just being like embedded in language and embedded in culture was then ripped apart with the values that were imposed as part of colonialism. So we created a lot of homophobia and sexism around the world. Well done, us.
And I understand what you're saying about it's really hard to answer from your specific perspective, because I'm like that as well. Like, I've been, for as long as I can remember, the person that people talk to about emotions. Like, for most of my male friends, they talk to their girlfriend, their mum, and me about how they're feeling. Then it seems like they're very sensitive and they're very open about how they're feeling, but they're probably not to anyone else. But it suits me just fine, because I can't contribute on, you know, football, but I can talk to them about emotions all day. Like,
yeah, so you might have a warped vision, which is like, I don't know, men seem fixed, they just all cry at me. I don't know what it is.
I don't know if that's a good thing, actually. What am I doing? So it's interesting. And so in terms of where you're at now, like, how do you think gender influences your emotions? What's that kind of interaction like?
I like to think I'm sort of over it, but now I'm in a long-term committed relationship, and I'm very aware that within that I have some typically male behaviours. For instance, you know, I won't raise issues, I won't open up within that space about things probably as much as would be healthy. Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, in many respects, I was lucky in that my dad is a very sensitive guy, but he's obviously conditioned as well by his father and other men around. So, for instance, just with small things, like he had to unlearn some of his own limits in some ways. Like he was sort of happy for me to be the kid that performs on stage and stuff, but he would still, when I wanted long hair, he'd still secretly ask the barber to shave it off. And then I'd cry for a day and a half. And it's like just these things that needed to like be unpicked slightly. But that was never the worst masculine.
But it seems a little bit like with that example, that was potentially more about him as well. Because like I had an experience with an ex of mine where, like, I think we can relate on this. My hair is quite important to me. And I like plan it out yearly. And it's ridiculous.
Yearly?
Yeah, it's a whole thing. So I, with that.
Are you looking to publish a calendar? Is that why? Are you getting merch?
Well, I do modelling. I actually could do a calendar. Shall we do it? Yeah.
I'm so busy right now. Please leave me. No more.
So with that, I remember one time we were having a conversation and I was considering growing my hair long, kind of stereotypical girl length. And he was really against that. And it kind of dawned on me that that was actually nothing to do with me. It was to do with his ideas of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And that with him being gay, that was some kind of weird threat to him, that he wanted someone that looked like a stereotypical bloke.
Yeah.
That was what he was attracted to. And also he seemed to be concerned how other people would perceive, not just me, but how people would perceive him being with me if I had long hair, which is quite a lot to unpack there. And
yeah, that's a really gross element of a lot of gay men's culture, is that sort of fear of the effeminate. And again, this is the thing about coming back to like the mainstreaming of drag, in that actually it's like, oh, so now it's fine, is it? For a lot of the kind of, you know, muscly masculine guys who are now huge fans of that show. Mm-hmm. And I just think there's a warped relationship there where then it's almost being treated in exactly the same way as like maybe when sort of straight culture adopts drag as like, oh, just a thing to try. Oh, it's just a bit fun just to try on. Like, oh, don't I look silly? Silly is reductive.
Yeah, it's more than that. And also, from what I do know about drag, there seems to be more recently this trend towards looking like hyper feminine and convincingly so, like being passable. I can understand that's what some people want to do with their performance, but with that being increasingly the norm in drag, that doesn't necessarily mean progress. Because if they're just going from like looking stereotypically male to looking stereotypically female, it's still the same binary thing all over again.
Which, yeah, if anything, I'm more into that, the drag that takes the notions of stereotypically female and turns them up to 15, you know, as a way to sort of say like, isn't it actually quite ridiculous that these are the expectations of women? My friend Victoria Sin is a fantastic drag artist, and they do that. Like their stage presentation, their stage character is like equal parts like Jessica Rabbit and Marilyn Monroe, and then like laced with like beautiful like references from sort of 20th century Chinese cinema as well, and sort of silent movies and stuff. But, you know, it's this great presentation of like, well, you know, if my waist is 3 feet wide and my boobs are 4 foot wide and my, you know, and it's just like, you know, am I woman enough now? Is this what you, like actually, I think that's where we can find, like I say, that sort of radical potential.
Yeah, that's when it really like, challenges.
Turn everything up. Rather than just this, like...
Absolutely. And that seems in many ways, you know, more vulnerable and more real. People fluctuating like that. Because, you know, that's something that I experience where sometimes, you know, I tend to dress quite androgynously a lot of the time. And that's nothing to do with me wanting to be female. Like, I'm very content in my maleness. But I don't really feel as restricted by what I should wear because of the parts that I have. And so for me, that's a bit of freedom. And that's a bit of some days I want to dress like this and some days I want to dress like this. And it's all part of my wardrobe portfolio. It's all part of who I am as a, you know, non-single-sided being.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, just interested to sort of, so many prongs to this question, I don't really know how to phrase it, but like basically what I think a lot of our listeners will want to know is how you have manage that balance, I suppose, between toxic masculinity and taking care of yourself and doing the work that you do.
In my show, I do sort of sketch out some of the parameters of maybe what happened in my family in terms of certain men leaving, certain men being abusive and driving people away. But the point of the show was I didn't want to focus on that. I didn't want to give time to that. If anything, I wanted to give more time to the people who did survive it, and then maybe think about some of the repercussions of it. So, for instance, we've talked about how, you know, we don't expect ourselves to think in such a tradition, you know, we think we're better than that. We're such modern, cool people. Why am I shocked if I see a man cry? It's because that's in the air. That's just around you. You're breathing it in. And so, for instance, the point of my show is that I sort of say, you know, I moved in with a partner and I found myself like gendering the experience and kind of trying to like run away from being feminized by people, seen as like the woman of the couple. And then when I clocked myself doing that, I thought, well, that's gross. Why would I actually do that, when in fact I was raised by a number of women who had to survive some pretty horrid things, which were created by the fact that certain men in their lives were so repressed, they didn't know how to deal with what was inside their heads. They couldn't express it. Maybe, you know, some of them couldn't even read or write. They just like, they had to work down the mines, or some of them were very intelligent men, but they perhaps weren't the most emotionally intelligent because they grew up in academic environments and so they weren't nurtured in the other way. And it's like, you know, all of these different blockages. Well, it's the same blockage actually that's put in for various men that I hint at in the show, but I do not name or point fingers. I try to draw quite a clear line of like what the personal and public experience is in that show, basically so as not to play any victim games, not to paint any of the women in my family as victims, but only to talk about mine and our experiences outside of the behaviors of those men who were acting out because of toxic masculinity, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting what you said there about, I sort of felt this kind of ongoing struggle almost of the way you described it, that these men didn't have the tools to express their emotions. They weren't allowed to evolve them in the way that women are encouraged to.
Yes.
And then because we've got these phrases like, you know, boys don't cry and man up, these things are reinforced. And so they've got no tools to navigate the emotions. And then on the other side of it, they've got the constant, oh, but you don't get to show the emotions anyway, so don't even bother trying. And that's really, you know, what I think needs to end. You know, that's the whole crux for this episode, is that why depending on people's gender, it defines whether or not they're allowed to emotionally mature in a healthy way. Why do one half have to bottle everything up? And it's not that they do necessarily bottle it up completely. You know, I've been in relationships with girls where they have me as a support, and then they also have, you know, various friends and family. And then I've been in relationships with guys where more frequently they save the emotions for me because I'm their partner, or, you know, friends of mine will save the emotions for their girlfriend. And that's where they think it's acceptable. They go from their mum being an emotional crutch to their partner being one. So if ever there was an argument for the needing to be an outlet for male emotion, that's it. The need is there. It's just being put into one person. Like, you're only allowed to trust one person to let down the mask and show that you're actually not this version of masculinity. that doesn't fucking exist anyway.
Mm-hmm. You're quite right.
That's what I think about that. Grand. All right. So to finish up then, do you want to tell us anything more about your show or where it's best for people to come find you online?
Well, online, you could find me on Twitter at @JoeSutherland_ or on Instagram at @JoeModity, JoeModity. I've also got a website if you're old school. And this show, Toxic, will hopefully get a London run soon enough. And in fact, we might also be filming it for distribution later in the year. So follow those social things and I'll announce when those things happen.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Our petition to get mental health education onto the curriculum for all schools is continuing to gather momentum, and the Department for Education has now put forward initial plans on how to make this happen. If this petition is something you'd like to learn more about and hopefully sign it and share it as well, you can find out more at bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for that is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.